You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Republican Congressman Reid Ribble isn't seeking re-election this year. We talk with him about his efforts at bipartisanship in Congress and his take on the candidacy of Donald Trump.
First, campaign season is in full swing as the nation prepares for the presidential election in November. There are a lot of important issues facing the nation, but toxic discourse often shuts down meaningful conversations. Here are just a few examples.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
A small, insecure money grubber who doesn't care who gets hurt so long as he makes a profit off it.
Susan Fluke, who goes before a congressional committee and essentially says that she must be paid to have sex. What does that make her? It makes her a slut, right?
The real reason that I'm recusing myself from voting for this bill, Mr. Speaker, is because it sucks. This bill sucks.
That was presumed Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, right-wing radio host Rush Limbaugh, and Wisconsin State Representative LaTanya Johnson from Milwaukee.
James Hogan joins us to talk about the toxic state of our public discourse and how he thinks we might be able to clean it up. He's the president of the Vancouver PR firm Hogan & Associates, chair of the David Suzuki Foundation board, and founder of the website DSmog Blog. He's the author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, James, what got you thinking about discourse and how it has taken a turn for the toxic?
Well, it was actually I've been involved in environmental issues for a number of years, and it's always astonished me how we seem to, on so many of these issues like climate change and other issues like the state of the oceans, be listening to each other shout rather than listening to what the evidence is trying to tell us. And so I started interviewing people about that question and interviewing social scientists and so on, and quickly learned that it's not just the environment that has that problem. It's pretty much anything that's kind of a big, important, contentious issue. And we seem to be so much better at polarizing than we are at finding common ground where the solutions usually lie.
And you're not just talking about politics here. We know there can be a lot of heightened rhetoric when it comes to politics, but you're talking about what you call the public square. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's the place where we have conversations about collective problems and challenges. And I'm a public relations person of 30 years, so in my country considered probably the most senior guy in this profession, if you want to call it that. And I think more and more over the last few years, I've seen the industry become more interested in attacking opponents than informing people. When I started out in the public relations business, it was a business of persuasion. And now it seems to be more and more as these big issues start we start to face issues like climate change, and industries have difficulty making an argument. Instead of trying to make the argument, we end up in these kind of name-calling exercises. So politics has the worst part of politics has started to seep into other kinds of public discourse in communities.
What you're saying there reminds me of your conversation with Roger Connor, who was a lobbyist and a litigator, and he had an interesting story. It sounds like he started out, his MO was to identify the enemy, the person who would be labeled sort of evil, and then destroy that person or that message, and it was very effective for him, and all of a sudden he realized, you know, this isn't really that helpful all the time. Can you tell us a little bit about what he taught you?
Yeah, he's talked about something called the advocacy trap. And he said it's kind of where you end up when you have a name 'em, blame 'em, shame 'em approach to dealing with issues. And that what ends up happening is that, so say I care deeply about something. It could be environment, it could be some other kind of issue. and I speak up on it. I'm active on it. I'm participating in democracy and speaking up on behalf of a certain social group or environmental problem or whatever, and someone disagrees with me. We seem to be quite quick to assume that people who don't agree with us are that they're either stupid or they're up to something. And before we know it, we move from thinking that they're wrong to thinking that they're wrongdoers and feeling like we're in a battle between good and evil, and I'm David and they're Goliath. And you start to have feelings of self-righteousness. And when you start to feel self-righteousness, it's easy to justify damn near anything, is what Connor says. And I think that's true. You end up in this state where you're just in a perpetual fight, and the fight becomes more important than the issue. And winning and defeating the person on the other side starts to dominate. And then when people look at the issue from the outside, the general public, they just see one person on one side of the issue, another person on the other side of an issue, neither one of them willing to budge an inch, and so they just turn off. And so we find ourselves in that situation on such a wide range of issues today that I think we need to go back and start to look at some of these skills that we've had in the past of finding common ground, because I think that's where we all know common sense tells us that the solutions lie. They're, no one's going to kind of dominate everything and make the world in their, you know, in their values without and totally ignore other people. I mean, we need to learn how to work with people that we disagree with and even people we don't like.
We're talking with James Hogan right now. He's the author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. And looking at common ground, I mean, it's a term everybody knows, but what we don't know is necessarily how to find it. It's easier to stake out opposing corners on an issue. What do you suggest based on your research about how to begin to get toward that place of common ground?
I think some of it's really simple. I mean, it's just as simple as assuming that people who disagree with you aren't necessarily, that their intentions aren't necessarily bad. That good people can do bad things for good reasons. And it's not only other people who can be under the influence of bias and be wrong. We can also have that problem. We're all, as human beings, subject to the forces of bias that we may not be aware of.
Are we fighting against the way we're wired at all when it comes to that? I mean, it sounds as though, in some ways, our brains are wired to want to protect our beliefs, and we want to justify ourselves when we think we're right, even if that means maybe twisting the truth a little bit.
That's true, and I think tribalism or community, if you want to give it a softer term, is like that. You know, there's huge benefits to being part of a community, to being part of a team, but there's also drawbacks. You know, we naturally unite into teams, we divide against other teams, but we also, in doing that, can become blinded to the truth, and we can start to, when evidence comes along that sort of contradicts the beliefs of our community, we can get ourselves into the habit of actually changing the evidence rather than changing our minds, right? So I think it's part of it is just an awareness of the shortcomings that we have as human beings and as our communities have, and being more open-minded. And maybe even holding our beliefs lightly, which is advice that Carol Tavris, a psychologist who wrote Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, some advice that she gave me. And I think that's very good advice, holding our beliefs lightly.
You have a chapter in your book on gaslighting from the famous movie where someone is made to believe that they're crazy. They're not really. And you talk about how this can be applied to this same argument about discourse. How does gaslighting figure in?
Gaslighting is this, I didn't realize this, but it's actually a term of art in psychology where people can start to lose confidence and in their own perception, and become really dependent on the person who may be working for them to lose their confidence in the way they see the world. And you can do that on a mass scale. One of the people that I interviewed in the book talked about it and actually wrote a book about it. And you can get, it's basically the manipulation of fear. And basically taking, using people's fear against, to undermine their reasoning and to get them to do things that aren't necessarily in their interest. This kind of thing actually happens. People in my business more and more use social science to design communication strategies. And sometimes those communication strategies are just used to disrupt the conversation, to sort of undermine public discourse.
What's an example of that? Just a quick example, but what?
Climate change denial. It's basically there was a massive program that was undertaken by a number of industry organizations that the sole purpose was to convince people that it was junk science and that the science wasn't reliable or that it was biased or that it was hokey. But what was happening there was an exercise in actually trying to change the meaning of the science to, and add a kind of a partisan meaning to the science of climate change. And so it became not is the science reliable, but this isn't something that people like you and I believe in. If you do believe in this, then you're not part of this team. You must be part of that team. And that's not how normally we should be processing information.
James Hogan's with us right now. He's the author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Why do you think public discourse has gotten so toxic? What do you think needs to be done to clean it up? How do you make sure your conversations stay productive, especially when you're talking about politics or other hot-button issues? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with James Hogan. He's the author of the book, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up.
And we're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to happen to clean up our discussion of important issues like climate change? Why do you think the public square has gotten so polluted with misinformation and toxic discussions? Do you think it's possible to clean up our public discourse? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take our first caller now. We've got Chad on the line in Dubuque, Iowa. Chad, hi.
Hi, how are we doing today?
Good, thanks.
So I guess my point was, or my comment is, I think it's important to find out what your areas of agreement are with somebody that you're having a debate or a disagreement with. And just to give one small, quick example, like with instance to the conflict in Israel-Palestine, you can find out, you know, something that you agree on that maybe there are people over there that's suffering and something has to be done about it. It's just a matter of then working out the differences in either who's at fault or how you might fix it. I guess that's sort of.
Chad, thank you for the call. And Jim, tell us about finding that common ground initially, especially, I mean, that's Israel-Palestine. That's a difficult one. In situations that are that fraught, how do you begin?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. This idea that just acknowledging another person's point of view or trying to find something in their point of view that you agree on can kind of start the conversation so that there's it is a conversation rather than just a monologue. And I think what the caller said is exactly right, that this idea that I think probably on most issues we agree on most things. There may be like 25% of the area that we have problems with, But when we're really right in the middle of the most combative part of that 25%, it's hard to see the other 75 or 80% of issues that we may agree on. And so I think a lot of the time, for me, it may not always be that there's common ground, but I think there is a lot more common ground than we think. And you want to, if you're not going to find common ground with somebody, at least you should know why. And it shouldn't be because, for tribal reasons.
Hmm. Well, thank you. Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think I finished it. But it shouldn't be for tribal reasons, and it should be conscious. And so I think trying to explore common ground and things that you agree on can actually start a conversation where you can actually start to realize that the person isn't an idiot because they disagree with you, right, on the other side of the argument.
All right, getting back to the title of your book, I mean, you're basically saying it's an ironic title that no one's an idiot. We just haven't figured out the common ground yet, it sounds like.
Well, I'm not saying that no one is an idiot.
Oh, so some people are idiots.
I think there's far fewer idiots than we think. And I think assuming that somebody is an idiot is probably a big mistake.
Not a good starting point either. Okay, well, let's go to our next caller. We've got Chance with us in Osseo. Hi, Chance.
Hello there. Very wise words coming from your guest, and I appreciate the conversation. What I wanted to say, you were speaking on the dangers of self-righteousness, and I'll admit I am a self-righteous person, and I have a difficulty avoiding that. In particular, in the example that he brought up on the subject of climate change, when your, I won't say opponent, though I very often view it that way, but your fellow citizen in discourse refuses to acknowledge what are commonly held as facts, where do you go from there and in a conversation, and how could you possibly avoid becoming self-righteous in a situation like that?
Okay, thanks, Chance. Good question. And Jim?
Yeah, great question. And one of the people that I interviewed was this French intellectual, Bruno Latour, and he talks about this very specifically, that his feeling is that we need to stop arguing about facts, who's got the bigger facts, and start to shift the conversation from arguments about facts to conversations about concerns.
What's wrong with conversations about facts? Because it seems like, I mean, the fact is supposed to be something that you can prove, I guess, with physical knowledge, with science, and therefore it should be something that's sort of beyond positions.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea and probably works okay when we were in university. But in the real world, we have facts are sticky, difficult things. They're not just totally objective. In fact, most facts are subjective. And so what's a fact and what's not a fact, and is it my fact or your fact? These things can be the source of huge amounts of discord. And they don't, you can look at it in the climate change debate, they don't actually clear up the debate. So the concern is not that facts aren't important. Of course they're important. We want to have evidence-based policies, but it's more that arguing about facts doesn't actually move forward towards solutions as smoothly as we think. In fact, I think you can endlessly argue about facts with somebody who doesn't think climate change is happening. It's just there's no use in it because they're not going to change their minds. But you could actually get people who don't want to admit that climate change is a problem to even agree to price carbon, or to, you know, put in place clean energy solutions. So as long as you're not imperialistically requiring that before we have an agreement on moving forward with good policy that person admit they're wrong, that you can actually maybe get something done.
Well, thanks a lot for bringing that up, Chance. Appreciate that. And Jim, you didn't just speak with sort of philosophers and scientists. You spoke with people in the spiritual realm. You spoke with the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh. What did they have to add?
Well, Thich Nhat Hanh was just amazing. Well, so was the Dalai Lama. But I'll just tell you one moment from both of those. So I spent an afternoon with Thich Nhat Hanh with David Suzuki, who's a Canadian scientist and environmental advocate. And Thich Nhat Hanh was telling David that we needed to bring meditation into the work to protect the environment. And he was talking about inner ecology, and I started to think, like, is he just saying we shouldn't be advocates? So I said, you know, I know that your monks and nuns in Vietnam posted these pictures of police on the website, the police that were harassing the monastery. Now, that seems to me to be advocacy. You're not suggesting that environmental advocacy is a bad thing, that we shouldn't be advocates, are you? And he looked at me and he said, speak the truth, but not to punish.
And what did you take away from that?
I think it is that we want to speak up against injustice, and we must, but not in a way that causes more hatred or that unnecessarily personalizes the issue that you're talking about. And it sort of ties in with what the Dalai Lama said to me, which was, you know, at the end of the interview, he pointed at my forehead and he said, we like to think the Western mind is more sophisticated, but I think that the Tibetan heart might be stronger. Maybe if we take the Western mind and the Tibetan heart and we join them together, we may be able to fix some of these problems. We were talking about climate change. And what he was talking about is warm-heartedness and empathy, which translates into, you know, respect or just being more human with other people who disagree with us, so that we're, you know, as one of the callers said earlier, looking for things that we have in common and not making these sort of assumptions about people's moral fiber or their intelligence.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
That was James Hogan with us, the president of the Vancouver PR firm Hogan & Associates. His new book is called I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. This is Central Time.